So any questions? Yes. Yeah, $100 laptop, PC and... $100 laptop. Yeah, well, it's probably not going to be $100, and it's probably not going to be a laptop, but it's certainly not going to be a desktop.
$100 thing.
Yeah, the $100 thing. Yeah, so a great, very edifying trip on the web is to usatoday.com, and one of the services they have on there is really wonderful, which is the top 150 selling books in America. Not in New York as the New York Times, but it's basically in America. And they also, every 10 years or so, they give the top, there's one of the categories, the top 150 selling books in the United States over the last 10 years. So if you take those, and I do this every year or so, I'll go there and look at both of these things. And I'll go through, and they don't sort them in any way except in rank of sales. But what I do is go through there and try and pick the books that are part of our built-in cult universals, like which ones are stories and et cetera, et cetera. And then which books are about powerful ideas that were, had to be invented, like even agriculture had to be invented, but certainly math and science and stuff like that. And I've never yet, so I lay the thing out, about 70% of all of the books over the any 10-year period are fiction. So they're stories. And some of them can be stories that attempt to look at us in a more modern way, but they're basically in a narrative form. And then there's self-help and religion, cooking, et cetera, et cetera. Smaller percentages. Never have I found a single book on science being in the top 150, either in a year or over a 10-year period. So McGraw-Hill did a survey that said, of the people in America that even read books, how many books do they read a year? And the answer is an average of 10. So if you take that fact with the USA Today thing, that the small number of Americans who are even reading a book each year are basically reading books about the things that would have interested cave people 80,000 years ago. So one answer to your question is, well, yeah, take a look at books and take a look at the web, and you can see this thing endlessly recapitulating itself. But the most interesting thing about books is not those books. Most interesting things about books are the books that actually made the changes, right? So it's basically not about voting here so much. It's about trying to understand the difference, basically what's going on in most people's brains. And the most important thing about scientists is that they are as human as anybody else. So scientists get angry, they lust after things. Some scientists believe in religion. For some scientists, their science is religion. All kinds of weird things that are completely opposed to science. And because science is this skill, so if a scientist is lucky, it's more like playing tennis a few times a week. You know, for a few hours at a time, the scientist thinks differently about things. Or the 55 people in the Constitutional Convention over 6 weeks did something really amazing. even though what they wound up with was a compromise, still was an amazing thing for 55 people to be able to do in a short time to come up with that document. So the answer is that there is not only no way of preventing it, don't even want to prevent it. So if you take Martin Luther as a way of doing things, and also look back at how a lot of scientists got their start, they got it from reading really good science fiction books in the 40s and 50s. In fact, there are some science fiction writers like Robert Heinlein that wrote some of the best science fiction that was ever written for teenagers, in which there is a complete narrative structure. And unlike science fiction movies, which have almost no science content at all, these science fiction books had an enormous amount of science content and got many, many people extremely interested while they were still young in following up the ideas that were in there. And I think that for younger children, that it would be absurd, for instance, in first, second, third, fourth, or fifth grade, it would be absurd not to mix the two. That Martin Luther's idea was to not just have people read the Bible, but to have them become more edified as a result. So he was on this same path. His idea was that something that we now know to be true, that just becoming a reader makes you a different thinker, regardless of what you read. $0.03, actually.
If all we do is continue as a culture to push, to basically keep pushing the lowest, or the highest, I guess, signal noise ratio content into that stuff, is there some magical...
Well, I don't know. So, one of the liberating things about meeting Seymour in 68 was I suddenly realized I didn't have to worry about adults in personal computing anymore. And never been a big fan of adults. And the adult problem, to try and bring a new medium into existence and try and make something that is relevant for adults who have at their best, a lot of range. So my initial aim for my desktop machine I did for my thesis was thinking about what people at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton would do with such a thing. And that led to this idea that that any computer designer could not know enough of what all of these different people did to provide them, but we'd have to provide them with an authoring medium that they could shape themselves. So language has this nice property that language does not have to know what Einstein does, but Einstein can use language to shape. So, but still, that is a really daunting thing. And as soon as I saw Seymour's stuff, I realized, oh, if you just stick with kids, you've got a very, very worthy and large user group, and you can do powerful ideas, and you can also be much simpler about it. You don't have to teach, you don't have to worry about advanced math that some PhD is going to use. You only have to worry about teaching 10-year-olds calculus, right? And that's a doable thing. And the same thing, you don't have to worry about all the features an adult needs. You just have to have a user interface that children can use, right? So same thing with the third world. The idea is, yeah, America is daunting. There are huge forces that are contending for everybody's brain time. It's a guerrilla war. Neil Postman said the thing that should be taught in American schools is how to be a media guerrilla, right? Because children are defenseless against what they see on television. They don't realize they're being assaulted. They think they're being entertained. And this is spreading to the rest of the world. It's going to make it gradually more difficult as the rest of the world. So one of the big worries on the $100 laptop is, will certain third world countries who need it more than anything reject it because it's not as trendy as the stuff that they see on television? So you go to any American slum, and people may be starving, but they have a TV set, maybe two of them. So, you know, so the trick on this stuff is it's a little bit like cathedral building in the sense that there are an enormous number of different things to do. The cathedral builders knew they were going to be dead before it got done, but still they thought it was a worthy project. And so the idea was to advance it while you're alive, and other people will keep on doing it. And I think that's the way knowledge really, really works here. I don't think you can try and the other way is if you look at history, so some of the people I work with occasionally get discouraged, not often, but sometimes they get discouraged, and I say, look, 500 years ago, things were much worse. So if you look at things in a 500-year thing, it was pathetically bad 500 years ago. And so in a 500-year period, big things have happened. And then you can slice and dice it a little bit more to even look at things that have happened in the last 50 or 60 years and realize, wow, just to take a, here's a powerful idea that is not in any human nervous system, has never been discovered, is not universally found in cultures at all, is the simple idea of human rights. Right? And that idea has been around for a few hundred years. The Greeks certainly didn't have it. They had slaves. We've mouthed it, but we've had slaves. But in fact, just getting a lot of the dirty laundry out didn't happen until the 60s. Right? And people say things are worse now since the 60s, but I think it's better to have this ugliness exposed in so many different ways, and now we have to deal with it rather than trying to cover it up again. That's the way things actually work. Because most people will not change just because they're in the presence of a great idea. That is not why most people do things. Only about a few percent of the population respond to ideas directly, and everybody else has different reasons for doing those things. And part of the theory of school is to teach these hard-to-learn things in such a way that we get gradually stronger ways of dealing with some situations. So this is not an attempt to reform the world so much as to improve it. So if you think of this from the standpoint of improvement, and that's what I'm asking people to think about, is it's not a question of saving things, it's a question of improving things in a reasonable way. So I think I had till 10:30. I'm sorry I've answered just your question, but I'll take one more question then quit. Yeah. Well, I think of Nicholas as the James Bond of computer science. You know, my basic image of him, I've known him for 40 years now, and my basic image of him is stripping off a wetsuit to reveal a tuxedo. This is the iconic James Bond image, and he's a bit European in many ways, and you can just put it down to a culture clash between two people who are very sure of their positions. You know, of course, Nicholas did not go in there and ask this guy in some beseeching way. He went in there and said, "You must make a $100 computer." You know, it's completely obvious you must do it.
So there isn't a structural thing of why this isn't just happening.
Well, it's basically the. You know, first, it's right on the edge of being able to do it in a reasonable way, because the teetering thing is the price of displays. So 2 years ago, we did an enormous amount of work on, when we were at HP, on a thing we called a Super PDA. And it was interesting because the cheapest display that would do the job just 2 years ago was $100, and it was an obsolete, it was an 800 by 600 display, and there are a couple of factories that made them. So these are kind of remainders from a world that had gone on to XVGA. And but we realized, oh yeah, there's a real opportunity here, because with that $100 display and another 60 or so dollars worth of stuff, we could actually make a Super PDA for children that we could sell for what regular PDAs are sold, make a good profit for HP, and we'd have a $400 or, you know, $350 computer that we could put into American education. So that was the plan on that thing. So 2 years later, the DVD gave us a smaller display, 800 by 480, but at a much smaller price. And there possibly of going a little bit lower. And if you turn the crank a little bit on it, we're right on that teetering thing. And but the other thing is, the manufacturer that Nicholas walked into was making his money by putting Microsoft software on it at a huge premium and then charging a big profit margin on top of that. So in order to get the thing down to $100, you have to get rid of the profit margin and you have to get rid of Microsoft, right? And Microsoft does not like being getting rid of. So I'm sure there are a lot of practical reasons in this guy's mind when he threw Nicholas out.
So what happens to those practical reasons and reasons and the project?
Well,
the project succeeds and changes
that. Yeah. Well, basically, we're, you know, in theory, doctors should be happy to retire when they cure the patient. So one of the ways of looking at the $100 laptop is it could fail, but in the process of failing, it's going to shake a bunch of things up. I don't think it's going to fail. But once this happened, you know, when Brazil reverse engineered the AIDS drugs, all of a sudden the big pharmaceutical companies in the world dropped their prices offshore America, because nobody could afford them in any of these developing nations, and they were just letting people die. But so the Brazilians said, well, screw that. You know, this is something, again, this is something the Indians could do also. Basically, screw that. We've got enough people in university here. We'll reverse engineer these drugs, and they did. And it was exactly the right thing to do. And as soon as they did that, the pharmaceutical company said, whoops. You know, sort of like the movie studios fighting videotapes. Remember, there was a huge thing there, and the movie and sales stuff is more than the box office now. They just didn't understand. So the business people should understand something about pricing. But in fact, they don't. They will only reprice when somebody forces them to. So another way of looking at the $100 laptop thing is it is a proof that things can be done cheaper and done in a different way. It also will be an excellent validation of free software, I believe. And those two things are likely to shake up the world completely in the next 5 to 10 years. And if any country steals this design, we couldn't be happier. It's like Jerry Rubin, who was a revolutionary, and yeah, steal this book, exactly. Steal it, yeah, absolutely. Remember, John Holt said mathematics would be so much easier to teach if it were made illegal. It's a good way to stop. Thank you.
Right, so well, the panel that originally was going to start at 10:45 will move back 15 minutes, so we'll meet back here at 11, and then we'll just end that one 15 minutes early, so we'll still break for lunch at noon. Thank you.
I just talked to the phone.